Brighten up your home with help from Menards. Illuminate your home with LED light bulbs from Fight Electric. They provide light that lasts with a rated life of over 10,000 hours. Don't wait to finish your projects. Save big money on Fight Electric LED light bulbs now at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money
at Menards. This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Salve and salutations. My name is Charles Chestnut. This is Storied History, and this story is about rum. Now, right off the bat, I am not going to be covering the answer to the eternal question, why is the rum gone? But we may cover the much more interesting question, why is the rum? Meaning, why does it exist, what did it do, and what part did it play in some cool stories throughout history? Now, obviously, this episode is going to be dealing with alcohol. Literally 100% of this episode, or 200 proof, is going to be alcohol-related. So if that bothers you, or if you have little ears and you don't want them to hear this, well, now would be the time to switch off. If that doesn't bother you, then I should also say that, I have been indulging and imbibing myself, which may come, may become apparent later. But hey, I'm going to be talking about rum, so I did indulge in a little rum. Okay, so alcohol. Alcohol in general is created by yeast. Yeast are microorganisms that eat sugar and expel, well, alcohol. You can put them in a liquid with something for them to eat, and they will eat, and they will expel alcohol, and then they die. In fact, they die because of alcohol. Alcohol kills microorganisms, and yeast are microorganisms, so alcohol kills yeast. And there is a limit for the yeast to tolerate. It seems to be about 15%. Over the centuries, yeasts have been specifically bred to make them very hardy, that they can tolerate higher alcohol levels. But 15% is a good general mark. So they produce the alcohol, and the alcohol kills them, and the yeast die, and you drink the results. And the result is, well, wine and beer. That's not rum. Rum, whiskey, gin, vodka, all these liquors, all of these things are distilled alcohol. So what is distillation? Distillation, in a very simple description, is when you heat a liquid and the liquid turns into a vapor. You cool the vapor down, it recondenses back into a liquid, and that new liquid has different properties than the old liquid. This has been known for quite some time. In fact, Aristotle, the ancient Greek philosopher, noted that if you distill salt water, the resulting water is no longer salty. He did not fully understand that then, but we definitely do understand that now. It's just science. You can distill any liquid, and the liquid that is most commonly distilled in the modern world is alcohol. By such a large margin, it's not even worth talking about anybody else. So the term distillation really means making liquor now. Although technically, distillation can refer to any liquid. But now it's just alcohol. So alcohol has a lower boiling point than water. Water boils at 212 degrees Fahrenheit, 100 degrees centigrade, and alcohol boils at 173 degrees Fahrenheit or 78 degrees centigrade. What does that mean? Well, that means that if you heat up a liquid that has alcohol in it and you keep the temperature between 173 degrees and below 212 degrees, then the alcohol within it will boil away while the water will not. You can capture the vaporized alcohol and then you cool it down, and it distills into pure, or, you know, in reality, semi-pure alcohol. That's it, in a nutshell. That's how it's done. And the very first person that we know to actually do this was an Arab in the 8th century. He was a scholar, and his name, mispronounced, was Yabir ibn Hayyan. The resulting liquid is not 100% pure alcohol. There are a lot of impurities, and there is actually some water in there too, because some water will evaporate with it, although the boiling point is technically lower. That's just what happens. But if you do it again and again and again, you can further purify the resulting liquid. In fact, the modern word for alcohol has its roots in an Arabic word, alcohol, which basically meant any purified substance. So fast forward a few hundred years in Europe, and they knew distilled alcohol, which they called the alcohol of wine, which was thought to have healing properties. They called it aqua ardens, the burning water, probably because it would light in a fire, but also because when you drank it, it produces the burning sensation in the throat. But if you get past the burning sensation, then it made you feel happy and alive, because, well, it's a shot of pure alcohol. And because it made you feel that way so quickly, they also called it aqua vita, the water of life. And they really did think that this had healing powers. In fact, there was a professor at a French medical school in Montpellier named Arnold Villanova, who produced the instructions for distilling wine in approximately the year 1300. And what he said was, "The true water of life will come over in precious drops, which being rectified by 3 or 4 successive distillations will afford the wonderful quintessence of wine." That is his quote. We call it aqua vita, and the name is remarkably suitable because it really is a water of immortality. It prolongs life, clears away the ill humors, revives the heart, and maintains youth. And at the time, it was actually thought to basically cure everything. They really did believe this. And it makes a sort of sense if you think about it, because back then, water could actually be bad for you. Because if you're drinking just water out of a stream, it may have a lot of bad things in it. Well, living things in it that could have a bad effect. But wine, or beer, even at low levels, has, by its very nature, has alcohol in it. So it's safer to drink than just water from, let's say, a pasture with cows all around it. So mildly alcoholic wine and beer are actually safer to drink than water back then. And if you distill it down to its purest form, well, that's the magical elixir. That's what makes wine wine and beer beer. So, therefore, it's what makes wine safe and beer safe, and if you drink it, well, it makes you safer, and you're going to be healthy. It's kind of a strange, twisted version of the truth, but that is what actually they believed. You can kind of see how they got there. Enter a king, Charles the Bad. Now, I'm torn on that name, because, you know, my name is Charles. He is a king, which is interesting, but he's a bad king because he was ruthless and was not particularly intelligent, which often goes the way of our rulers. Anyway, he was the king of Spain, and they called him Charles the Bad. In 1386, he was sick, but he was also very rich, obviously, because he's a king. So he had his doctors soak sheets in the water of life and then wrap him up. Now, by the way, this story does not end well. So late one night, Charles is wrapped. in sheets that have been completely soaked in pure alcohol, in the water of life. He thought that it would grant him immortality. He had hoped that the prolonged contact with the magical fluid would cure him of any illnesses and make him immortal. It did not work out that way. So he's actually wrapped in his sheets, like bundled up tightly, like kind of like swaddling cloth for a baby, tightly wrapped in these sheets that are completely soaked in pure alcohol. And they did this at night. And back then, this is well before, hundreds of years before electricity, so the only light was from fire. And one of the candles, or at some point a spark, or who knows, touches the sheet and the entire thing goes up in flames, including Charles the Bad. And because he was fully wrapped up in his sheets, he could not get out. And he died. And that is a very bad way to go. Fast forward a few hundred years, the distillation of alcohol has spread across Europe fairly effectively. In pretty much every country, they had their own distinctive type and flavor. For example, in Germany, they simply called it Burnt Wein. In German, Branntwein, which then was then transliterated into English as Brandywine, or simply Brandy. There were people, again, all across the entire continent, that would make their own, or distill it into their own liquors, and sell them on feast days, pretty much to whomever would buy it. The quality obviously varied quite significantly. But this practice was actually banned completely in the German city of Nuremberg in 1496, where a local doctor observed, in view of the fact that everyone at present has got into the habit of drinking aqua vitae, it is necessary to remember that the quantity that one can permit oneself to drink and learn to drink it, in according to one's capacities, if one wishes to behave like a gentleman. That is good advice, and it is one that I am guilty of not following all the time, including perhaps at this exact moment. Oof. The burning water indeed. In the British Isles, the Gaelic word for aqua vitae is actually the origins, and I'm actually not going to try to pronounce it, but is the origins of the modern word whiskey. One historian recorded in the death of 1405 the son of an Irish chieftain, and he said that he had died after drinking the water of life to excess, and for Richard it was in fact the water of death. Yeah, gotta be careful. But we are here to talk about rum. And so that really began with the European discovery of the American continent. So, believe it or not, 1492 actually does set the roots for rum. And I'm going to have to say this right off the bat and very clearly and concisely. Rum, and pretty much most of what we're going to talk about from here on out, is inexorably linked to the slave trade. They do not exist one without the other. They are completely linked. And so pretty much everything else that I talk about is going to involve slavery in some way. Even if I don't explicitly say it, it is true. Now, slavery on a mass scale had been outlawed in Europe for many, many centuries at this point. Saying that it was against Christendom, it was against God. And it had not been legal for, a thousand years. But when the desire for humans to make sugar arose, that protection did not extend to the enslaved Africans. Rum is made from sugar, and it is the sugar production which so closely related to the enslavement of millions of Africans. And the distilled alcohol in its general form was, in general, much better suited to sea voyages than for wine or beer. And so it was involved in that aspect as well. Now, for one thing, it's a lot more concentrated. Rum is much more concentrated in its form than beer or wine. You can pack more of it into a small area. For another, alcohol is a preservative, so something with high concentrations of alcohol is not going to spoil, whereas beer or wine would. It's also highly desirable for people to drink it, to get drunk. And so the distilled alcohol actually became part, an essential part, of the slave trade itself, because it was used as a commodity. It was used as a means of purchasing the enslaved Africans from the African slavers. So essentially what was happening was that very, very frequently there would be warring tribes within the African continent, and there would be people that would be captured by other tribes. And they would be taken to the slave markets on the coast, and they would be sold to the slave traders. And these slave traders, Africans themselves, would then sell them to the Europeans. And what the Europeans would very, very, very frequently pay for with the currency that they used, the thing they traded for, was liquor. It was rum. It was highly, highly prized, and that's what the Europeans used to buy people. They didn't have a common currency to use, and this was something that was very highly prized and valued, so that's what they would use. At first, they didn't use rum. They used brandy or burnt wine, but as rum was then developed shortly thereafter, that became the preferred trade. It was actually a custom for the Europeans to present very large quantities of alcohol as a gift through negotiating with the African traders for the purchase of the enslaved Africans. It is completely, as I say, inexorably linked. This became further profitable and further linked to actually a much larger degree with the cultivation of sugar. So sugar was immensely profitable. It was very labor-intensive at the time. You took sugarcane sap, you basically boiled it until there was nothing left. The result was a form of sugar. And what they were doing, what the Europeans were doing, was to import the enslaved Africans to the Western Hemisphere to work in the sugar plantations, where they would then be making sugar that could be sold in Europe. By 1750, sugar was the most widely traded and valuable commodity in all of Europe. And that simple fact is what drove and shaped the lives of millions of people. Extremely dangerous to make up until... Well, there was a man named Norbert Rilieu, the son of a slave born here in New Orleans. He actually invented the process that we still use today to make sugar without killing the people that are making it. But I digress. By the way, a further digression, his life is actually very fascinating, and I might actually end up doing a episode on him himself, Norbert Rilieu. But he did not make rum. Okay, so the very first sugar barons came from Barbados. Making their production of sugar made them the richest men in, well, definitely this hemisphere, and also in Europe as well. They were some of the richest around. But it very quickly spread to the Caribbean. Sugar is very profitable, and it can only be grown in very specific climates. So if you could grow sugar, you did. One of the byproducts of making sugar was molasses. Now, molasses itself is not very sweet. It is kind of bitter. It's not like maple syrup. It is not pleasant to consume by itself, so nobody did. As a byproduct, it was actually used to feed livestock sometimes, basically pigs. But, and this is the actual very important part, at some point people figured out that the byproduct of the sugar-making process did not have to be thrown away or just fed to pigs. Instead, you could turn it into alcohol. And one of the most important points there is that in order to make it into alcohol, you don't have to first make a liquid that tastes good. You can, sure, if you want to distill a delicious wine or beer, you can do that, but you don't have to. all you really need to make this distilled liquor is a liquid that can be fermented. The yeast have to like it. But the humans don't. It doesn't matter. And that's why you can make it out of molasses, because the distilling liquid is not going to taste good, but the distilled liquid will. Hence rum. So it becomes the importation of equipment and knowledge from Brazil that actually changes our story here. The sugar barons and the people that ran these facilities learned how to distill the byproducts of sugar, the waste products, into a powerful alcoholic drink. The Portuguese called it cane brandy because they made it from the foam that was skimmed off of the boiling cane sugar, the cane juice. This process was very much refined in Barbados because the cane brandy could be made from molasses. So, hey, we were going to throw this stuff away or feed it to the pigs, but maybe this waste product is something we could sell. And this is a new alcoholic drink, rum. Importantly, they could do this without cutting into the production of actual sugar. So they can still make money that they would have been making anyway, but now there's this whole other market. So basically, if you're going to refine wine into brandy, well, you're going to lose the wine. But if you're going to refine molasses into rum, you're going to lose the molasses, but you were going to feed that to the pigs anyway. So they can have their sugar and drink it too. And that's rum. That's the new alcoholic drink. Now, the original name was actually Rumbullion, Rumbullion. And it was sometimes called the Chief Fuddling or Kill Devil. Rumbullion is a slang word, or was a slang word, meaning a brawl or violent commotion, a big fight in southern England. And you can obviously draw your conclusions there as to why that would have been an appropriate slang term. Rumbullion was shortened to rum, and it spread very, very rapidly for a few different reasons. And number one, there was a huge amount of it. They didn't have to change what they were doing, not really. They didn't have to start growing a new crop or eliminate an old crop, like, you know, wine into brandy, that sort of thing. They were already making the crop, that sugar. And it's a waste product, molasses, and now we can turn this into something else. The capital investment was very easy because you're already doing it. You're already making a lot of money from the sugar. So in order to invest in some other equipment that you can use to make more money, well, that's an easy step. And because molasses was a waste product, it was incredibly cheap. So extraordinarily inexpensive. It's not like I have to now grow new fields of barley or wheat or hops or grapes. It's just, hey, cheap waste product, basically free. Let's see what we can do with it. And so there's no lack of supply. And there was a demand because everybody liked it. Rum actually became a form of social control, partly because it was so cheap and easy to get. Slaves that were well-behaved were given rum. Servants that did above and beyond their normal station were given rum. The Royal Navy in the Caribbean in 1655 changed their official ration from beer to rum. And a century later, it became the universal standard for the entire British Royal Navy. They chose rum primarily because it was the English planters that were producing the molasses in the Caribbean and the West Indies that were very politically powerful. And the Navy would then be buying a byproduct of their product. And so the very wealthy and powerful and individuals became, well, more wealthy. There is an actual logistical reason for that, though. Because it was controlled by British hands, and it was just British liquor. And if the British Navy is going to be required to produce and distribute a substance or a drink, you're going to want one that's homegrown, so to speak, instead of one that was produced by their rivals, their enemies, or even their allies. You want one that the British are doing, and so, well, that was rum. So the Royal Navy starts to distribute rum. But how do you know if the rum is good rum or not? Well, we're not talking about taste. We are talking about the quantity of the alcohol within the substance. So how are you going to test it? Well, as legend goes, it was the Royal Arsenal, which is located on the southern bank of the River Thames in southeast London, that actually came up with the process by which you could prove that the rum is actually quite strong. And the way they did this was to mix up the rum with a little bit of gunpowder and then let it dry and then heat the mixture using a magnifying glass and the sun. And if the mixture ignited, it was strong enough. If it didn't ignite, if it didn't actually burst into flame, then it was too weak. And occasionally, as the legend goes, it would be the rum was actually too strong. It would explode a little bit and hurt the individuals around it. Although I really do find that hard to believe because gunpowder, if it's not under pressure, if it's not contained, all it does is fizz. It doesn't actually blow up. So that legend is probably not true. But that is where we get the term proof. So proof is the strength of the alcohol contained within the liquor. And it's basically doubled. So in rum, in America, over the shelf is 80 proof or 40%. That's where we get it. Well, that and taxes. But I will cover that in a bit. Now, this next bit. I cannot overstate how important this next portion is to world history. In fact, as far as decisions go that are somewhat innocuous at the time but have huge, massive, long-lasting implication, this one is up there at the very top. And as far as decisions go that involve alcohol, this is without a doubt the king of them all. This is the single most impactful decision involving alcohol in the entirety of human history. There has never been a decision involving alcohol that had a greater impact on the history of the world than the one I'm just going to explain and hear now. I know it sounds like I'm overselling it, but I'm not. This is actually true. Okay. I'm going to have a little bit of rum. Hang on. All right. So, there was a man, an English admiral named Edward Vernon. Edward Vernon was born in 1684, and about 50 years later, he is in command of hundreds of ships, tens of thousands of men. And he puts out a new order, and that order had to do with rum. And at this point, the distribution of rum to the sailors was actually very, very common. In some parts of the Navy, it was actually universal. So in 1740, Admiral Vernon was a very powerful, very well-respected, and very wealthy man. And he had a very specific nickname because he had an old coat that he would wear whenever he was on board, whenever he was on ship. It was an old coat that was very waterproof that was made out of a cloth called grogram. It is a very coarse fiber that is coated with waterproof stuff. It is not very comfortable, but it is very effective for keeping out water. And although he was very wealthy and powerful at the time, he could have afforded the very best possible, like, tightly woolen cloaks that anyone could buy if they had enough money. He did not. Instead, he kept his old coat, the coat that he had been using when he was first on ship as a young man. He kept it, and because he had kept this old grogram coat, he was given the nickname Old Grog. If you can see where I'm going with this, well then, well done you. In 1740, Admiral Vernon, who at that point was had about 200 ships under his command, so he's very, very high up, he gave them an order. Now, the order had to do with rum and water. The water was tending to spoil, and the sailors didn't want to really drink as much of it because it was starting to get nasty in the casks for months at a time. So He made the order that changed the way they were going to drink the rum. Instead of just giving the Shalers two shots of rum and, hey, here's your rum for the day, they were required to mix it with a very large quantity of water so that then they would also maintain hydration. The rum mixed with the water, especially if it's not really great water, was not very palatable to the sailors. They didn't really enjoy it. They didn't want to drink it. So he, as a side note of the order, told them not to just dilute the rum, but to flavor it. And what he specifically said was, the sailors that are good husbandmen may from the savings of the salt and provisions and bread purchase the sugar and the limes to make it more palatable to them. And that's it. And I don't know if you caught that, but that is literally what changed all of world history for the next 150 years. It was the order to make a new drink, which was diluted, but they were encouraged and in some places required to flavor it with sugar and limes. That new mixture was called grog, after his coat, after old grog. And it might actually be the very first cocktail, and that is debatable, but honestly, this is 100 years before the other claims to be the very first cocktails, because this is 1740. Rum, water, sugar, lime. That's grog. That's originally grog. We're not talking about the kind of fake pirate version with the gunpowder. A grog is a great name for a drink, and if I drink enough of it, I will start singing about it. So, it's all for me grog, me jolly jolly grog. It's all for me rum and tobacco, for I spent all me tin on the lassies drinking gin. Far across the western ocean I must wander. Now that is a very poorly sung old drinking song, but that's the great thing about old drinking songs. It doesn't matter how poorly you sing them, as long as you get the drinking part right, which I have. And that's one of the actual oldest sea shanties, the drinking songs. This, not the fake kind. It was actually written like 20 years ago and people pretend it is. That was actually written originally back in the 1740s. Now, the question is, did you catch it? Did you understand it? Did you follow it? The important part. The part that changed world history. Did you? Because I've said it three or four times already. Oddly enough, it appears nowhere in the actual song. Because when they wrote the song, they didn't realize how important it was. The British Royal Navy, beginning with Admiral Vernon's order, began switching their sailors to a diet that included a daily dose of rum, water, sugar, and limes. And by the way, that's where we get the slang term limey. That's where it comes from. Now, at the same time, the French were shifting their soldiers off of wine into a similar distilled liquor for essentially the same reasons. It's more compact. It can store longer. It's not going to go bad. And because they were French, they were distilling wine. And the distilled product contained no vitamin C. So at the same time that the entire British Royal Navy was now feeding their soldiers vitamin C on a daily basis, the French were not. They had removed all of it, which meant that the British Navy was protecting all of their sailors from scurvy, even before they really knew what scurvy was and what it was caused by. Now, all the sailors did know about scurvy. They did. This was a common thing everybody understood. It was a wasting disease. But they didn't understand it. They didn't know where it come from. They had no clue. They thought it came from maybe drinking bad water or maybe having an upset stomach too often, like acid reflux disease, that kind of thing. Which is sort of understandable because one of the first visual confirmations of scurvy is the blackening of the gums. And they thought maybe if you had acid reflux and heartburn, you're throwing up too much, that's what's causing it. That's why. They're wrong, but that's what they thought. What they did not know was that scurvy is caused by not having enough vitamin C. And as I said earlier, scurvy is a wasting disease. It operates over very long periods of time. It makes you weaker and weaker and weaker and more prone to injury, more prone to having cuts that will not heal, that sort of thing. Which means that if your crew has scurvy, even low levels of scurvy, they're not going to be operating in a quick, efficient, effective manner. Which means that if you've got one Navy going up to fight another Navy, and one of them has scurvy running rampant through the ranks, and the other one is completely free of scurvy because they're eating limes every single day, then the one without scurvy, the British, has a huge advantage, a massively powerful advantage. Such an advantage that later, much later, when the British figured out what was going on, they didn't tell anybody. They kept it a very close guarded secret because they didn't want the other navies from their rivals around the world to remove their built-in advantage, which is, you know, that's understandable. Admiral Vernon's, Old Grog's, decision to dilute the rum and to encourage his captains to flavor it with sugar and limes in order to make it more palatable for the sailors is one of the reasons that the British Navy became the dominant force on the planet for the next 150 years. Rule Britannia. Britannia rule the waves. Now that comes from a poem written the same year that that order was given, 1740. Although that is just a coincidence. Or is it? Yes. Yes, it is. It is actually just a coincidence. Now that is a great story, and I do love that bit. When I dug into this, trying to figure it all out, put it all together, all the little pieces, and put this whole thing together, when I came across that little portion that actually makes that intersection, that connection between other these seemingly disparate events throughout human history, I just loved it. My eyes just lit up. This is why I enjoy history so much. Now, I knew about scurvy. I knew about the British Navy. I knew about Rule Britannia. I knew about the limes and the limeys. I even knew about grog. But I did not know how they were all connected. And I certainly did not realize that the order to feed the sailors limes came well before people knew why that should be a thing. So, moving into American history, essentially what was happening, what had happened, is that the British colonies in what is now New England were not doing very well. And the primary reason for this is because of the climate difference. Now, this may sound strange if you don't actually know how true this is, but if you look at a map, the latitude for New England, for the northern part of the American states, is about equal to the Mediterranean Sea. They are essentially parallel to each other. So the British Isles are actually would be equal to the northern portions of Canada. But specifically, the New England portions are equal to the sun-drenched coasts of the Mediterranean. So the northern Mediterranean Sea in southern France is about equal to, well, New York on the 43rd parallel. Now, what this means is that the people that were colonizing the Americas, or rather the people that were sending other people to colonize the Americas, had assumed completely incorrectly that they would have similar climates. They don't. Anyone that has traveled internationally knows this is true. The winters in the Mediterranean Sea are a lot warmer and more sunny and more pleasant to be around. They are a lot more like Florida, which is rather farther south, than the New England states. So the colonies in the northern states, New England, every time they tried to grow the same stuff that was grown in the Mediterranean, it didn't work at 100% failure rate. You couldn't just plant the same trees. You couldn't plant olive trees and grape arbors and citrus fruits in the northern New England states. It just doesn't work. It's just too cold. The climate, although on exactly the same parallel, is completely different. And that, by the way, is almost entirely because of the transfer of heat in the Atlantic Ocean into the northern parts of the ocean by one of the largest heat transfers on the entire planet, the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation. And you don't want to know how many times I had to try to say that in order to get it pronounced correctly. Because, like I said, rum. Splice the main brace. But I'll get to that. The AMOC is a kind of a conveyor belt, basically. It transports warm water from the equator to the northern parts of the Atlantic Ocean, which makes the European climate much more pleasant, much more warm than it otherwise would be. And because it primarily operates in a basically counterclockwise direction, it doesn't happen on the U.S. side, but it absolutely does happen on the African and European sides of the Atlantic Ocean. And that's what warms up Europe. Without the AMOC, well, it's changing, and we'll all have to see how that ends up collapsing. But I digress. Anyway, that's why. But the upshot for this story is that the things that they were trying to grow in New England just didn't work. And every time they tried to make it work, it just didn't. So the New England colonies, the people living there, were trying to find some sort of product that they could export. The southern states were doing this too, but they were a lot more successful at first, because they could grow tobacco, which you couldn't in the northern states. And boy, did they grow tobacco. And they still do. It was very, very profitable and has worked very, very well as an agricultural export. The New Englanders needed a kind of a homegrown industry, something to export. And because it was too cold and the soil was too rocky anyway, and nothing was working, the citrus fruits, the olives, the grapes. They tried to make wine, but by all accounts it was disgusting. They tried to import raw goods from Europe to make other stuff, but that didn't work because it's just too expensive to import raw material from Europe and convert it in New England and then send it back to Europe. That, well, involved crossing the Atlantic Ocean twice, and so that's rather expensive and time-consuming, and it just didn't work. All of this changed in the latter half of the 17th century because of rum. They were able to import the molasses that was incredibly cheap, because remember, it's a waste product, from the Caribbean into New England to make rum. So going back to like how you actually make rum, you take the distilled liquid and you put it in oak barrels or charred oak barrels. And that's how you age the fermented liquor. You know where oak trees don't grow? The Caribbean. You know where oak trees do grow? New England. So it's a symbiotic relationship. The first rum distillery showed up in New England in the 1680s. And this is more than 100 years before the American Revolution. And what they were doing was they were importing the molasses from the Caribbean. When they get up to New England, there's a wealth of oak trees up there. They make the barrels. They char them. They age the rum in those barrels. And after a few years, it is this dark, wonderful stuff that is highly prized, desired, and valued all over the world. So for a little while, Rhode Island rum was actually used as a form of currency in Europe. But it was not Rhode Island rum that was successful. It was the New England rum that actually won out over everything else, because it won on two issues: price and consistency. And that is a very nice way of saying that it's cheap, it tastes cheap, and it is consistently cheap. And then, decades later, it becomes one of the first, very first, heavily taxed goods in the English colonies. And the taxes varied in strength. The more strong the rum, the more tax you'd have to pay. So they had to prove the strength. And where's the proof? Well, they used the same process that the British Navy was doing, using gunpowder. So there you go. Over several decades, the molasses became incredibly important to the New Englanders. And so it is no wonder that the New Englanders panicked when England tried to impose an import tax on molasses from the French colonized islands. It was a tariff. The English were going to impose a tariff on the importing of French molasses into, well, New England. And that was going to drastically raise the price of the good and make it more difficult to get, because, you know, that's what happens. This eventually leads to the Sugar Act of 1764, where the tax was officially levied on the importation of molasses, and that actually began the very earliest rumblings of the no taxation without representation, which grew stronger over the next few years, eventually culminating in the American Revolution. But, and this is just kind of cool to note, the very first problem beverage, the first taxed beverage that made everybody angry, was not Boston tea. It was Caribbean rum. Well, not really. It was Caribbean molasses that became New England rum. It's also not surprising that once the fighting actually began in the American Revolution, rum was again one of the most sought-after commodities. One general writing to George Washington in 1780 was quoted as saying, "Besides beef and pork, bread and flour, rum is too material an article to be omitted. No exertions ought to be spared to provide ample qualities of it." So there you have it. And by the way, the real rum runners, which is kind of a general term for bootlegging, although very celebrated in story and song, basically it wasn't running rum that was causing so much problem or so much profit. It was running molasses to make rum. But there you go. So the rum was actually inexorably bound to the American Revolution and as well bound to the British Royal Navy. Splice the main brace. Strong stuff. And rum in the British Royal Navy had a very wide and interesting history, which I have pretty much covered, but let's finish up the rest of it. After the order from Admiral Vernon, later it became formalized, much more formalized at least, the tot, as they called it, T-O-T, where the daily rum ration. And the exact amounts would be given out to every sailor every single day. And this continued all the way up to 1970, which, hey, seems rather late to me, but what do I know? I'm not a sailor. It was actually July 31st, 1970, or as the British would say, 31 July 1970, that became known as Black Tot Day, the death of the tot. That's when they stopped serving the rum to all sailors. And did the sailors take this lying down? Well, yeah, they did, because it was orders. Did they protest? Well, no, because, you know, there were orders. But did they mark the occasion? Yes. Yes, they did. Black's Tot Day. There are reports that the British Navy staged funerals on land and at sea in the land-based training camps and at sea, or the death of the rum ration. They would take empty rum bottles and throw them into the sea, treating those empty bottles as if they had been the bodies of dear departed comrades. And for a while after that, on July 31st, or rather, on the 31st of July, British sailors would raise a glass and toast to the death of the tot, the end of the rum. I don't know if they still do that. I honestly don't. I looked. I couldn't find anything. I hope they do. I really do. Maybe it's just the historian on me. I hope that on the 31st of July, British sailors raise a glass of rum and toast the death of the tot. The Royal Canadian Navy followed suit just 2 years later, 1972. They got rid of their tot. But it was the New Zealanders, it was the Kiwis, that held on all the way to 1990 before they finally got rid of theirs as well. Now, the privilege of awarding the sailors rum for good service was actually very common in the British Navy, and it still does happen. Now, shortly after 1970, the captains could issue those orders, but as time passed, the restrictions of who could actually order rum to be distributed to the sailors became more and more narrowed. You had to be higher and higher and higher up the ranks in order to give that order. So that now, the captains can't, the admirals can't, that privilege, that power, that authority resides only at the very top. King Charles, or technically a member of the royal family. But in reality, it's only the monarch. The monarch, the king or queen, is the only individual that has that power or has exercised that power in the last several decades to order rum to be given to the Navy. And it is an order called Splice the Main Brace, which I will do at the moment. So that's a slang term that refers to one of the more difficult but important emergency repair jobs in a sailing ship. Braces are the lines on a sailing ship. They're used to change the sails and maneuver the ships. The main brace is the longest brace, and if it is destroyed or shot away, the ship cannot maneuver effectively and may be destroyed. Splicing the main brace in the middle of a battle was a very dangerous, very difficult, but incredibly important job. So the individuals that were chosen to splice the main brace had been trained and practiced, and they were the most dependable in the entire ship. And if they spliced the main brace when the call was given and they were successful, well, one, it meant that everybody lived. And two, it meant that you got an extra shot of rum. Now, eventually, it became slang for giving everyone an extra drink. And certainly, as time passed, this was no longer necessary to splice the main brace, so to speak. Because there was no main brace, and so you didn't have to splice it. But the slang term was kept. And as these things so often happen, that slang was adopted and is now the official term. And it is still given on special occasions. For example, the 100th anniversary of the Royal Canadian Navy came in 2010, and Queen Elizabeth herself issued the order. Now, she is not someone that was given to using common slang, especially common sailor slang. And she was very prim and proper and used the proper terms for everything. Now, I'm not going to read the entire statement that was given out, and not just typed, but she said these things by Queen Elizabeth. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but the last few sentences are, Prince Philip and I send our warm good wishes to all of you and look forward to following your important endeavors as you sail to meet the challenges of another century of service. Splice the main brace. Which I will do now. The Queen's Diamond Jubilee celebrations in 2012 also included a Navy-wide issuance of rum, and once again, she gave the order, splice the main brace, which I just think is fantastic. And yes, to answer your insipid question, the coronation of King Charles did include the order given out to the entire Royal Navy. In honor of his own coronation, he did give the order, splice the main brace. All right, I'm going to close this up right here. I really did enjoy this one, once again. It's something that has always interested me, and I just kind of dug into it, and sure enough, it was incredibly interesting and fascinating. I do just love these amazing little connections. It's what makes the study of history so fascinating and so enjoyable. It's like a fireworks in my head when I find them. Nothing happens in a vacuum. It is the hidden connections that are the most fun to find. So I do hope you have enjoyed this as much as I have enjoyed making it, and I have enjoyed making it very much because, well, I have been splicing the main brace, so to speak. This has been Storied History. If you enjoyed it, please do share and subscribe. We are trying to expand our numbers, and if you do share these kind of episodes with anyone you think may be interested, it really does help. Really and truly, it does. The 5-star ratings are and reviews are obviously very important, and thank you all again for rating me so very, very highly. But sharing it with anyone you think might be interested is absolutely invaluable. Literally invaluable, because I sound like I have an advertising budget. Just a rum one. Splice the main brace. Also, if you want to watch me play video games and yell at the screen, trying to comment on the history and the lore and the real history of some games, fictional history and others, you can follow me on Twitch. That is Storied History on Twitch. I'm currently playing a game called Kingdom Come Deliverance, which is set in 1403 in the Kingdom of Bohemia. It is incredibly accurate, obsessively so, much, much more than I would have thought in the very beginning. I'm really, really, truly enjoying it. And tonight, I was actually playing just a few hours earlier, and there was a guy who stopped by from the... He said he'd gotten me from the podcast and wanted to stop by and check in and say hello. That was Willow402, and thank you for doing that. I really do appreciate it. All right, I am going to go and look for the next story. If I find it, I will try to get it to you. And if you find the subscribe button, I will be able to do so.
Storied History is written and recorded by Charles Chestnut in New Orleans, Louisiana, with audio production and original music by Seamus O'Connor. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe, and we'll see you soon.
Splice the main brace.